Joe Alonzo thinks ahead. When he was a teenager, he laid out a 10-year plan.
I would go to college right around 18, graduate around 22, and probably wouldn't get married until I was 25 or 26.
Joe is now 24, and he's getting married this year without the college degree he'd planned on and, for the moment, without a job. As part of our series Generation Next, we're hearing from people like Joe who've had to make hard choices and new plans in this economy. Guest correspondent Judy Woodruff has our final story.
There was a 40% chance of rain in New York City on the day I met Joe Alonzo. Some people might hear a number like that and take a chance. But Joe is the kind of guy who checks the weather and packs an umbrella.
I'd be surprised if the Mets get a game in today with all this rain.
He's walking through the Corona section of Queens, where he grew up and still lives.
As you can see, it's a very Hispanic-oriented section of Queens. There's a big Italian community around here, too. Turn here.
Joe's family is from the Dominican Republic. His parents came here when he was a baby and raised Joe and four younger siblings in a small brick apartment house.
And this is where I used to live, that second floor right there. It's a lot smaller than I remember, but then again, I was tiny.
When he was a teenager, Joe liked taking things apart and putting them back together. He took computer classes at community college, expecting to transfer to a four-year school. That was in 2006, before the economy went bad. But within his own family, money was already a problem.
My father at the time was self-employed, preparing income taxes, things like that. So his income was very variable. And my mother was and still is a travel agent. So, you know, there's a certain limit to what you can make. And it was tough with five children and rent and a lot of bills. And it was causing a rift in the family, you know. So it was something that was like, you know what, my mother and my father were the ones who raised me and I got to help them somehow.
So the plan that Joe laid out at the beginning of this story, where he'd have a four-year degree by age 22, he put that aside. He left community college to find a full-time job.
That was a tough decision because in the back of my mind, I just kept hearing my mother saying how she wanted me to finish college. But I just put my personal plans on the back burner in order to help them.
What did your mother say to you, though, when you made the decision to leave college?
She knew that I was mature enough to understand the risks. And she said, you know what? College isn't going anywhere. You know, there's always going to be a college that you could go to. But she completely appreciated it. You know, it did help her out.
Joe worked for a while, helped his family pay for groceries and other bills. Then he took a course to be a computer technician. Not exactly a four-year degree, but it gave him the credentials to make better money. He eventually did get an IT job that paid about $50,000 a year. One problem, the year was 2008, and the economy was falling apart. Shortly after he was hired,
I was let go. It was pretty surprising, actually. But, you know, even if I had a four-year degree, I could still be out of a job. In this economic situation that the whole nation is facing, you know, there's several people who have even their master's degrees and they're out looking for work.
And so is Joe. He's been looking for work for 5 months.
Hey, where are you? You want to meet us over there in Fridays?
His unemployment checks last through the end of the year, but he's imposed his own deadline. He wants a job by the end of next month.
All right, bye.
He's getting married in the fall.
How's work?
Boring.
Slow?
It was really slow.
Joe's fiancée is Criselli Perez. She's 23, works at a shoe store, and like Joe, still lives at home.
You hungry? Did you eat?
I had lunch.
What did you have?
They've known each other a long time and decided to get married 3 years ago. They settle into a booth at a restaurant, and Joe puts his BlackBerry on the table. On the screen is a picture that reminds him every day how much he needs a job. It's a tiny black-and-white smudge, a sonogram image. Criselli is 2 months pregnant, another unexpected turn in Joe's 10-year plan.
It was something that we weren't expecting to do so soon. We were actually expecting it to do it next year. But again, it was when I got the news, it was like I was so happy. And our whole family is very happy.
I guess I'm wondering, do you wish you'd had more time to prepare for this moment in your life.
Yeah, everyone does. This, even if we're sitting there with a bachelor's degree, a good steady job, and a baby comes into the picture, I think everyone at some point or another says, I wish I had more time.
Back in the restaurant, Chriselli is telling Joe about her wedding dress.
I would have paid almost the same if I would have gotten it at David's Bridal or any of those stores. So since he's a friend of my grandmother, he's trying to give us the good price. So that helps us a lot.
They want to move into their own apartment soon. And to afford the rent, Joe is thinking of taking any job he can get. Maybe he'll drive a city van for a while, he says. That's what his father does now. I asked Joe about his dad leaving the Dominican Republic 25 years ago to start a new life in a place that held so much promise. My dad, he says, I think he's more surprised by this recession than I am.
He really had great expectations for this country when he came here, and he never expected for this to happen to such a great nation. But I guess for my friends and I, we see it as, I guess since we read the history books and say, you know, it's cyclical. It's happened before. There's going to be peaks and there's going to be downfalls.
But it is a tough time, nonetheless.
Really
How do
tough.
You think it's shaping you as a person? How is it affecting you as a person?
Since this is actually the first recession that I can remember, it's prepared me in a sense by telling me, you know what, if it does get better, I have to be prepared for when it could go bad again, because you're going to have a family and they're going to be dependent on you to make sure that things get done and get paid and that you provide for them. So I just have to be more prepared for it if it does happen again.
Joe Alonzo's plans now sound different from the ones he made at 17. In November, a simple church wedding with a potluck dinner afterwards. In January, the baby comes. As for college and his career in IT, that will happen too, he says, just not exactly as he planned it. For NPR News, I'm Judy Woodruff.
Tune in tonight for Judy's final Generation Next story on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And you can find more from our Generation Next series at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. This week, it turned out that South Carolina's Governor Mark Sanford was not hiking the Appalachian Trail, as he'd suggested. Well, you know the rest of the story. He was really in Argentina, but it's another story. As it happens, another South Carolinian, our Thomas Pierce, actually did go hiking on the trail to find out how the recession is affecting who's out there this year.
For the record, my friend Brad Wright is not a drug dealer, but his new nickname does suggest otherwise.
My name is Pusher, because my friend said I looked like a drug dealer because I was carrying around a giant bag of ibuprofen and calcium supplements the first day, and I was offering them to everyone.
His first day on the Appalachian Trail, that is. Everyone out here gets a nickname, and Brad, Pusher, is an old friend of mine. We grew up together in South Carolina. He's changed some since he started hiking in March. He's 26 years old and leaner now, with a dark beard migrating down his neck. I joined him for just a few days near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia.
Maine is 1,165 miles away, and Georgia is 1,013 miles away.
So you're not quite halfway.
Not quite, about 70, 75 miles to go, I think. As soon as we cross this river, I believe we're in Maryland. I think actually, let me check that.
He's right, it's Maryland. We hike for a few miles between the Gray Potomac River and the C&O Railroad track. Pusher the Backpacker used to be Brad, the office manager for a commercial real estate firm. When development slowed down last year, he started plotting an adventure in them there hills over the cubicle walls.
And I didn't put in my two-week notice until February of 09, so I was the only one left in the office by the time I quit.
Quitting your job, or even just putting it on hold during a recession, would be a non-starter for most. For one thing, hiking the length of the trail can end up costing a couple of $1,000s. But my friend Pusher, he's not the only hiker on the trail who's taking a risk to be here this year. Meet Couscous, so named because
I eat couscous with cinnamon and sugar, and somebody thought it was weird.
Every meal?
No, actually, just a couple of times. I haven't had couscous in weeks.
Couscous is Kim Morley, a 29-year-old environmental consultant from Atlanta. She says she's wanted to hike the Appalachian Trail for 7 years.
I really just had to make the decision to say, okay, this is the year that I'm doing it. And then it really wasn't difficult after that. May not have been the best time to take a leave of absence.
Couscous admits she's a little worried about being away from work for so long. Times are tough, and what if they forget about her, way out here in the wilderness?
I send out emails from towns to a bunch of people, and, you know, I just copy my boss on it, so they know where I am, and so they kind of know I should be done in September at some point and back.
Also on the trail this year are the Duder and his dog.
And her trail name's Donnie. It's kind of like off the Big Lebowski, but she's out of her element.
The Duder, whose real name is Chris Lee, climbs the stony steps into Harper's Ferry. This is where the headquarters for the entire Appalachian Trail is based. When the Duder gets there, he drops his pack and sits on the hot concrete and gets Donnie some water. His girlfriend is coming to pick him up.
I don't see how people can get off for 6 months at a time.
What are you doing when you're not doing this?
I just graduated, so at this point, nothing.
He's 26 and wants to get into journalism. He says hiking the trail could be something of a resume builder, but then again,
there's never a good reason to be hiking senseless miles. I don't care what anybody says. And if you talk to any hiker, there's no good reason to be doing what I'm doing right now, especially the through hikers. I was talking to one old man one day, and he said, this is hands down the single most selfish act one person can do. Just leaving all of your people behind to worry about you.
But he sees an upside, though, too.
And I think if by doing something like this, hiking for long distances, you're somehow getting in better touch with yourself. It's all about individual perception out there. And ticks.
Internet access here. You guys expecting any packages here?
Inside, the headquarters is hopping with backpackers. Maps and guidebooks line the walls, and it smells, well, it smells not so bad considering no one's had a shower in days. Here, they can check email, charge cell phones, stretch out on the couch, and enjoy the electric foot massager. All through hikers get their picture taken here, too. The photos go in big black binders dating back for decades. Not much has changed over the years, other than the gear and maybe the haircuts. Many hikers do carry iPhones and Blackberries, but the trail continues to lure people who just want to get away from the world for a couple of months. What changes most is the world they're getting away from. Just ask Rusty Towery, a.k.a. Wheeler, a 26-year-old mountain biker from Georgia.
I was laid off in November.
What do you do?
Worked for Caterpillar, but great opportunity. I have no, you know, major responsibilities yet in life, so might as well do something like this now while I can instead of having to wait like the other half of the population on the trail, you know, retired age.
It's true. The trail is generally split between 20-somethings and retirees. Wheeler says when he comes off the trail, there's a chance he'll already have a new job lined up.
I had a few things come about from the trail, people I've met.
I never really thought about the trail as a networking for a job.
Yeah, oddly enough, it's been pretty productive in that regard. Figured something good's got to come out of a hike like this. When I was starting off, I had friends that were going, man, I hope I get laid off, you know.
As for my friend, Pusher, he packs his tent in the early morning before we part ways. He says he's not thinking about the economy or what he'll do after hiking the trail. He's taking it 1 mile at a time, and he has 1,000 more before Maine.
All right, man. It's good seeing you.
And he's off into unknown territory. When he emerges on the other end, there's no telling what the world might look like. Thomas Pierce, NPR News.
Don Quixote, Sancho Panza, Legs, you can meet more of this year's backpackers in an audio slideshow. Come to npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. American workers over the age of 50 are rethinking their futures. According to a new survey, nearly half of them say that in just the past year, they have had to change their retirement plans and keep working. For more on how the recession is changing retirement planning and reshaping the workforce, NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giewax joins us once again. Hey, Marilyn.
Hi, Leanne.
Tell us a little bit more about this survey and what people are saying about their plans for retirement.
Watson Wyatt, a retirement consulting firm, went out to interview a bunch of Americans about their plans for leaving the workforce. And the survey found that just in the past year, millions of people have really had to rethink retirement. This recession has done a lot of damage to people's incomes, and retirement savings have shriveled up. And don't forget, our medical costs keep going up. So when Watson Wyatt asked people about their retirement goals, they now find that half the people say that not only are they forgetting about early retirement, but really they're planning to work to 66 or beyond.
So how is that going to change the workplace?
For employers, this shift to older workers is kind of a complicated proposition. While you don't have to put money into training your younger workers, you have to pay more in benefits and wages a lot of times. One of the real problems here is that you don't want to discourage your younger workers. If you have a whole generation growing up feeling like Prince Charles, that you spend your whole life waiting to move up a notch, that's discouraging to the younger workforce.
What advice are the experts giving to people who are determined to retire no later than the age of 65?
Well, statistics certainly show that people really do need to just save more and cut their spending. 2 years ago, the Federal Reserve did a study that showed that median household pre-retirement group, you know, from 55 to 64, they had total assets, financial assets, of about $72,000. And, you know, since then, we know that the stock market is down. That pile has probably been whittled to about $55,000, and we know that our home equity values have dropped, too. So when you just look at the data, you know that people have to save more. And the latest Commerce report on savings shows that people are getting that message.
Where are people supposed to stash their cash for retirement?
It's funny, a couple of years ago, the trendy thing seemed to be to get these target date mutual funds, which you would put all your money into a retirement fund and somebody like Fidelity or Vanguard would figure out how to get you the right mix of investments to get you safely to that retirement date. But we found that when reality showed up last year and the stock market was terrible, a lot of those target date retirement funds did even worse than the market as a whole. So this dream of just putting your savings on autopilot is pretty much evaporated. My gut instinct is that people are probably going to move towards greater safety, do things like insured certificates of deposit and treasury securities, anything so that we don't go through this gut-wrenching feeling of losing money the way we've seen in the last couple of years.
Marilyn Giwax is NPR Senior Business Editor. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Paying with plastic isn't what it used to be. For the first time, Americans are spending more money on debit cards than credit. With debit cards, consumers are paying with money they have, not money they're borrowing, a positive thing in these debt-averse times. But as NPR's Martin Costi reports, the debit card's growing dominance means Americans need to learn a new set of rules.
You might remember this Visa commercial from a few years back. The scene is a deli where customers and clerks juggle orders in a perfectly synchronized ballet of commerce. What keeps things running so smoothly? Why, everyone's paying with a debit card, of course.
Because money shouldn't slow you down. Life takes faster money. Life takes Visa.
That commercial is rapidly becoming reality. Last year, for the first time, spending on Visa logo debit cards overtook spending on Visa credit cards. Not just the number of transactions, but also the total dollars spent.
You go to the grocery store and, you know, 10 years ago, maybe I would have written a check to pay for things at Trader Joe's, but now I use a debit card.
Anita Ramasastry is a former Federal Reserve lawyer. Now she's at the University of Washington Law School, where she specializes in payment systems. She says younger consumers especially have embraced the debit card, in part because it looks so familiar.
It looks pretty much like a credit card. Would you agree? Yeah?
Definitely.
The fact that a debit card has the same kind of number as a credit card means it can be used to buy things in person with a PIN code or signature, or if you go online without a PIN or signature. On some websites, that debit card number plus the expiration date is enough to buy you, say, a new TV, just like a credit card. But in cases of fraud, the two kinds of card are not identical.
With credit cards, by law, my maximum liability for an unauthorized transaction is $50. For debit cards, it's a more tiered structure.
Time is a factor. The longer you take to report fraud on your debit card, the less money you're guaranteed to get back. When it comes to debit cards, the law is simply less forgiving, something Ramasastry says doesn't make much sense since people use the two kinds of card interchangeably. In practice, many banks do offer credit card-style fraud protection on their debit cards. Bill Sheedy, president of Visa North America, says that's the case for cards bearing his company's logo.
We have provided to consumers of Visa debit cards or credit cards a higher level of protection, And the requirements for our issuers who issue those cards to consumers is that they provide zero liability and immediate credit to consumers if there is a dispute.
But that extra protection for debit cards is voluntary. Groups like Consumers Union say it's time to put the industry's best protections into law. At Visa, Bill Sheedy doesn't think consumers are that worried.
The trends are clear. The consumers and merchants want to transact in an electronic form, and we think Visa debit is a big part of that.
Still, not everybody's on board with debit cards. Remember that commercial? It culminates with a disaster at the cash register when one poor schlub fails to produce the expected debit card. Dave Ahrens remembers that scene.
The guy who slows everybody down is the one paying cash.
That's you.
That's me, always.
Ahrens just paid cash for a tea at a Seattle Starbucks, and he sits down to explain why it is he won't allow his bank to create a debit card in his name.
I work in information technology, and I can tell you that it's really tough for somebody to ensure that your data is going to be handled properly.
He just doesn't see the need for that 16-digit number to exist, especially if somebody might use it to clean out his bank account. He prefers to get his cash from the teller in person once a week. In these austere times, he says, there's nothing better than a wad of cash to help you keep track of your spending. Martin Costi, NPR News.
To read more about the differences between debit and credit cards, go to npr.org.